McKay didn't start Williams right away. The Bucs quarterbacks during their 2-12 second season had been Gary Huff, Jeb Blunt, and Randy Hedberg. McKay, not wanting to be completely dependent on a rookie, had signed two veteran quarterbacks, Mike Barilla and Mike Ray. Both had enjoyed some success in the NFL. Barilla had started for most of two seasons with the Eagles and had even made the Pro Bowl in 1975. Ray had played for McKay at USC, leading the Trojans to an undefeated season and the national title in 1972, and had been a backup quarterback for the Raiders when they won Super Bowl XI following the 1976 season. At the end of training camp, McKay decided to go with Dougie, with Huff still around as his backup for the opener against the New York Giants. Williams' debut was brief and painful. He completed two passes, one to a teammate, one to the Giants' Terry Jackson, who returned it for a touchdown. Always blunt, McKay called the pass a terrible blunder after the game. Williams didn't get a chance to redeem himself because near the end of the first quarter, he was hit late by the Giants' Gary Jeter while going out of bounds and came down on his shoulder. He could feel it pop, but ran back to the huddle and called a play. As he came to the line and tried to move the shoulder, he felt a searing pain and fell over in agony. "As I was lying on the ground, I heard a voice from the stands," Williams said with a laugh years later. "It was a woman, and she said, 'Lord, they done shot him!'" Williams sat out the next week with a shoulder injury, and Barilla got the start against the Detroit Lions. He, too, left injured, a reoccurrence of a knee injury from the previous season, and, as in the opener, Huff came on in relief. The result was the same. The Lions won 15-7. A week later, Williams made a triumphant return in Minneapolis, throwing a touchdown pass and leading the Bucs to a 16-10 victory, making the franchise's overall record 3-28. He started 8 straight weeks, and the team was a more than respectable 4-5 going into Los Angeles to play the Rams. But Jack Youngblood broke Williams' jaw on a blitz in the first half. This time Ray replaced him, and the Rams won 26-23. Williams didn't play again until the finale against the Saints, when he started even though his jaw was still wired shut. He didn't get much chance to make anything happen that day because New Orleans controlled the ball for 41 minutes and won the game 17-10. The Bucs finished 5-11, a marked improvement from their first two seasons. They were 4-6 in the games Williams started, two of the losses coming when Williams had to leave early with an injury. "All I wanted was a fair shot to play that year, and Coach McKay gave it to me," Williams said. "When I look back, I realize that if not for him and for Joe Gibbs, I probably never would have gotten that chance. There were still plenty of people back then who didn't think blacks were smart enough to play quarterback. I mean, Warren Moon had to go to Canada for 6 years before he got a chance. All he did was have a Hall of Fame career. There are plenty of other examples. One was Tony Dungy, the Hall of Fame coach, who led the Big Ten in passing during his senior year at Minnesota. Dungy went undrafted in 1977 and was brought to training camp that summer by the Pittsburgh Steelers as a defensive back. When NBC aired a piece on Super Bowl Sunday in 2018, about Gibbs's relationship with Williams, Dungy got choked up the first time he viewed the piece. "It meant a lot to me," he said on the air, "because it brought back memories of a different time. I'm very glad we've made so much progress since then." Progress, yes. But anyone who thinks that there is no racial prejudice involved in judging quarterbacks, even today, is naive. If you're a star, a first-round pick, a guy who was considered a lock starter, it's not a problem anymore most of the time, Williams said. Guys like Jameis Winston, Cam Newton, Deshaun Watson, the no-brainer talents, they don't have a problem. But there are guys who get taken lower because they aren't considered locks. Where did Russell Wilson go? Third round. Dak Prescott? Fourth. The other problem is guys don't get a chance very often to come in as backups to maybe get a chance to learn holding a clipboard. Backup quarterback is still, more often than not, a white position. There are exceptions, but not that many. There are also players drafted lower than they should be drafted for reasons other than race. Tom Brady, the all-time miss, was passed on 198 times in 2000 before the Patriots took him to backup starter Drew Bledsoe, because he hadn't started until his senior year at Michigan and was judged a poor athlete after the combine, where he ran a snail-like 5.28 40-yard dash. Wilson was overlooked because of a different sort of bias. He's only 5 feet 11. But there is still a tendency for many teams and scouts to give the benefit of the doubt to the white quarterback. In 2017, the Chicago Bears took Mitchell Trubisky with the second pick in the draft after he had been North Carolina's starting quarterback for one season. Trubisky checked all the scouting boxes for a quarterback, 6 feet 3, 220 pounds, with a strong arm. Deshaun Watson went 10 picks later to the Houston Texans after leading Clemson to a 14-1 record and a national championship. In his two full seasons as a starter, Clemson was 28-2. Watson is 6'2", 215 pounds, and also has a strong arm. But he's more mobile than Trubisky, a trait that many scouts saw as a drawback. A quarterback who can run is also a quarterback who can get hurt. That's the rationale, anyway. Watson was actually the third quarterback chosen. Patrick Mahomes, also an African-American, was taken by Kansas City, whose coach Andy Reid had made Donovan McNabb the number two pick in the draft when McNabb came out of Syracuse in 1999. Reid, in his first year as a head coach, was glad to have the chance to grab McNabb after the Cleveland Browns used their first pick as an expansion team to take Tim Couch. Houston took Watson two picks after Mahomes went to Kansas City. Williams was a big fan of Watson's because after the scouts had done all the breakdowns on hand size, arm strength, 40-yard speed, and muscle mass, there was one thing he noticed about Watson that he thought invaluable. He won games. There are times you have to look past a kid's one-loss record in college, Williams said. I love the way the kid competed, in addition to having all the physical attributes. Year two in Tampa Bay went considerably better for Williams than year one. It helped that the team was markedly better. The defense had steadily improved and had a genuine star in Leroy Selman. Plus, the starting quarterback had a year under his belt and felt a good deal more confident. I knew it was my team, for better or worse, in the second year. Coach McKay always had faith in me, but that first year, because of the injuries, I didn't improve as much as I thought I should. The second year, you could see we were becoming a good team and I was becoming a good quarterback. There were still racial slurs tossed at him when the team lost, but they happened less and less often. If anyone in the media questioned Dougie, McKay quickly backed them down. The team went 10-6 and won the NFC Central Division. They played Dick Vermeil's Philadelphia Eagles in the first round of the playoffs and beat them handily, 24-9. That put them in the NFC Championship game, one step from the Super Bowl. The day was a lost one from the start. The Rams had a defense as good or better than the Bucks, and they shut the offense down in the first half. Then, early in the third quarter, Williams got hit on a blitz and was knocked out of the game. Ray took over but had no more luck than Williams. The final was 9-0. The Bucks made the playoffs again in 1981 and 1982, the strike-shortened season in which teams played only 9 regular season games. Williams started 62 straight games dating to the last game of his rookie season and including the Bucks' 4 postseason games. But while his football career was going in the right direction, his personal life was not. His father had to have a leg amputated during the 1982 season, and then, soon after their first child, Ashley, had been born, Doug and Janice Williams learned that Janice, only 26 years old, had a brain tumor. Doctors performed what they hoped would be life-saving surgery on March 31, 1983, and the initial signs were hopeful. The hope turned out to be false. On April 7th, Janice Williams died, leaving Doug to raise their 3-month-old daughter alone. If Williams' personal tragedies mattered to Tampa Bay owner Hugh Culverhouse, he didn't show it in his contract negotiations. Williams recalled, "I can remember walking down the hall one day with general manager Phil Kruger and him saying to me, 'Mr. C told me not to make friends with his money.' In 1982, my 5th year as a starting quarterback in the league, I was the 54th highest paid quarterback. My backup, Mike Ray, was making more than me. I wanted $600,000 a year, which in that market was more than reasonable. Phil told me they were willing to pay me $400,000. $375,000 plus incentives to get to $400,000. That still wouldn't have put me close to market value, much less the value they should have been paying a quarterback who'd been a starter for 5 years and taken them to postseason in 3 years out of the last four. I'd have taken $500,000 because I didn't really want to leave, and I had other things going on in my life, but they wouldn't budge, not a nickel. I remember thinking to myself, you know what? I don't have to play football. I have a degree in education, and I need to be home with my little girl. So I quit. For a 27-year-old starting quarterback in the NFL to just walk out was unheard of then, just as it is now. There was no real free agency in those days. If a team put you on its protected list of 37 players, any team that signed you had to compensate the team you had left, making it more a trade than a free agent signing. Williams went back home to Zachary and taught middle school for considerably less than he would have made playing for the Bucks. I worked as a sub, filling in wherever I was needed, he said. Got paid about $50 a day. He also helped out with the football team. As far as he was concerned, playing football was over. A year later, the United States Football League entered his life. The USFL had been founded in 1983 as a spring football league with some big bucks owners behind it, among them Donald Trump. It signed a number of college stars and NFL stars, and William Tatham Sr., the owner of the expansion in 1984, Oklahoma Outlaws, decided he wanted Williams to be his quarterback. He asked Williams to go to dinner with him and sold him on the idea of playing in the USFL. Williams can't remember now exactly how much he was paid, but it was considerably more than $50 a day. More important, he wanted to play football again. I liked teaching, but I missed playing, he said. I was too young to never play again, and Mr. Tatham clearly wanted me. That was appealing. The Outlaws started out 6-2 in the spring of 1984, before losing their last 10 games. 2 years in, the league was already hurting financially, and the Outlaws were merged with the virtually bankrupt Arizona Wranglers and moved operations to Phoenix. Even in a much larger stadium, the team's attendance actually went down from 21,000 a game to 17,000 a game. Williams threw for a lot of yards again, but the team went 8-10 and missed the playoffs. By the end of 1985, the USFL was clinging to life. The owners had decided to move their season to the fall for 1986, but were counting on winning an antitrust lawsuit from the NFL to stay afloat financially. The league did win the lawsuit and was awarded $1 in damages, which became $3 after it was trebled under antitrust law. The league suspended operations, never to return, which left Williams out of a job. He was ready to return to Zachary when his phone rang. On the other end of the line was Joe Gibbs, who had become the head coach in Washington in 1981 and had won the Super Bowl after the strike-shortened 1982 season. Joe Theismann's career had ended on a Monday night in October when he suffered one of the most gruesome leg injuries ever seen on a football field after being tackled by the Giants' Lawrence Taylor. Jay Schrader had stepped in as the starter and played well. Doug, Gibbs said on the phone, do you think you can handle being a backup? Williams laughed, retelling the story more than 30 years later. Joe Gibbs to the rescue, he said, again. 3. To say that Joe Flacco grew up in a jock household would be an understatement. His father, Steve, was a two-sport athlete at Penn. His mother, Karen, played softball at the College of New Jersey, and he and his four brothers and one sister were all athletes. Joe, born in January 1985, was the oldest and the biggest, growing to a little more than 6'6" while easily carrying 240 pounds. Mike, his fourth brother, is just about as big at 6'5", but John, Brian, and Tom are all closer to 6 feet, much like their dad, who is 5'11", and their mom, who's 5'6". Knowing football as he did, Steve Flacco didn't allow his boys to play the game until they were 12. Joe was a good baseball player with a strong arm and might have succeeded as a baseball player had he stuck with it. But by the time he got to Audubon High School, it was clear his future was in football. Even before I grew, I always had a very strong arm, he said. I liked playing quarterback even though I didn't get to start until I was a junior. There were older guys ahead of me, so I had to wait my turn. but I feel like I was always meant to be a quarterback. Flacco had to wait again in college. Once he grew, he was recruited by a number of Division I schools, including in-state Rutgers, the University of South Florida, tempting for the weather, and Pittsburgh. Eventually, he chose Pitt because it wasn't too far from home, and the school had known national success in the past. Coach Walt Harris told him he'd be redshirted as a freshman because he had a fifth-year senior, Rob Rutherford, who would be the starter, and he would save a year of eligibility by sitting out. "I was fine with that," Flacco said. "I figured my chance to play would come the next year." Only it didn't. Harris had rebuilt a fallen Pitt program into a solid Big East team, but hadn't won a championship or sniffed a major bowl. There was some pressure on him beginning in 2004 to take the next step. As a result, Harris went with the slightly more experienced Tyler Palko, a redshirt sophomore, as his starter. And though in uniform and ready to play, Flacco was an observer for virtually the entire season. Palko played well, leading Pitt to an 8-3 record, the Big East title, and a berth in the Fiesta Bowl. There, they were routed 35-7 by Utah, the first team not from one of the so-called BCS leagues to receive a bid to a BCS bowl game. The Utes were 12-0 that season, led by a quarterback named Alex Smith. After going 8-4 and winning the Big East title, Harris left Pitt at season's end to become the coach at Stanford. Palko wasn't going anywhere, and Flacco knew it. He had hardly played at all during the season, completing one pass for 11 yards total. Dave Wannstedt, the new coach, wanted Flacco to stay. He could see Flacco's potential, as could Matt Kavanaugh, the ex-Pitt quarterback whom Wannstedt had hired as his offensive coordinator. Flacco knew there was no guarantee he would play and that Palko, after a full season as the starter, would have the advantages of incumbency. "I didn't really want to face the idea of sitting for two more years until Tyler graduated," he said. "I basically hadn't played for 2 years already. I wanted to get on the field." He decided to transfer. He knew if he transferred a level down to 1AA, he wouldn't have to sit out a transfer season. What he didn't know was that the rule applied only if the school he was leaving granted him a release. Wannstedt wouldn't release him, figuring if he had to sit out a year, he'd stick around. Flacco left anyway, transferring to Delaware, which had long been a Division I-AA power under legendary coach Tubby Raymond, who won 300 games and three national titles there in 36 seasons. Raymond was replaced in 2002 by Casey Keeler, a Delaware grad who'd had great success at Division III Rowan. In Keeler's second season, the Blue Hens won another national title, going 15-1. Quarterback Andy Hall, who'd had great success after transferring from Division I Georgia Tech, graduated and played two seasons in the NFL, and was replaced by Sonny Riccio, another D1 transfer. Riccio would be a senior in 2005, and Keeler had Flacco penciled in to back him up and then be the starter the next two seasons. It worked out that way, sort of. Flacco had to sit out the 2005 season because Pitt wouldn't release him. He spent that season quarterbacking Delaware's scout team to prepare the defense for each week's opponent. Finally, Flacco became the starter at Delaware in 2006, after having played almost no football for three seasons. He played reasonably well and drew some attention from pro scouts because of his arm strength, but he wasn't high on any draft boards when the 2007 season began. Delaware was coming off a 5-6 season, Keeler's worst since taking over for Raymond. One team that was aware of Flacco was the Baltimore Ravens. The Ravens needed a quarterback, and had needed one almost from the day they moved to Baltimore from Cleveland in 1996. Vinny Testaverde had put up impressive numbers but hadn't won many games. Then Trent Dilfer won a Super Bowl at the end of the 2000 season, only to be summarily dumped because the feeling was that the Ravens' extraordinary defense had been responsible for the title, not Dilfer. There was truth in that, even though Dilfer had done everything he'd been asked to do once he became the starter midway through the season. The team signed Elvis Gerback to replace Dilfer and an aging Randall Cunningham as his backup. A year later, both were gone, and journeyman Jeff Blake and Chris Redmond shared the job during a 7-9 season. General Manager Ozzie Newsome and Coach Brian Billick were desperate to find a quarterback in the 2003 draft. During the NFL Draft Combine, they fell in love with Kyle Bowler, who'd had a good season in California after playing on bad teams prior to that. Bowler was 6'4" and had a strong arm, but he won the Ravens over when they interviewed him during the Combine in Indianapolis. Bowler was smart, funny, and charming. He came from a family of firefighters and figured to fit in on what was a blue-collar type of team. The Ravens had to give up their second-round pick in 2003 and their first-round pick in 2004 to the New England Patriots in order to move up to the 19th spot in the draft so they could draft Bowler. Four quarterbacks went in the first round that year. Carson Palmer at number one to Cincinnati, Byron Leftwich at number seven to Jacksonville, Bowler, and Rex Grossman at number 22 to Chicago. Only Palmer became a star. No other quarterback in that year's draft had any real impact on his team or the league. A year later, in 2004, Eli Manning, Philip Rivers, and Ben Roethlisberger went at number 1, 4, and 11, respectively. Manning and Roethlisberger have won two Super Bowls apiece, and Rivers has been a star for most of 14 seasons. All are still playing, and all may end up in the Hall of Fame. That's how hit-and-miss drafting quarterbacks can be. Bowler became the Ravens' quarterback at the start of his 2003 rookie season, and even though he missed seven games with injuries, replaced by Anthony Wright, the Ravens went 10-6 and made the playoffs. A year later, Billick brought in Jim Fossil, a close friend who had coached the New York Giants to the Super Bowl, only to lose to the Ravens four seasons earlier, to be Bowler's personal tutor. Bowler started all 16 games, and the Ravens went 9-7. He wasn't terrible, but he wasn't great. A year later, in 2005, after the Ravens had gone 6-10, they traded for 33-year-old Steve McNair. McNair had a superb season in 2006, and the team was 13-3 before losing in the first round of the playoffs to the Indianapolis Colts. A year later, McNair was oft hurt and clearly showing his age. By then, Eric DaCosta had become the Ravens' director of college scouting. It was his job to bring to Newsome the best quarterbacks who would be available in the 2008 draft. DaCosta was 37 and had played Division III college football at Colby. He had worked as a graduate assistant at Trinity in Connecticut, arch rivals of Wesleyan, the school that produced Bill Belichick, and was hired by the Ravens in 1996 as a scout when the team moved to Baltimore and Newsome was put in charge of player personnel. DaCosta had moved up the Ravens' ladder and had become Newsom's number two man in 2005 when Phil Savage left to become the general manager in Cleveland. He loved scouting, loved the adrenaline rush of seeing a player he thought could help the team. Flacco had first come onto his radar during the 2006 season when Joe Douglas, now the personnel director for the Eagles but then a college scout for the Ravens, had seen Flacco play in a game at Richmond. Delaware had upset the 10th-ranked in Division I AA Spiders 28-24, and Douglas had been impressed by Flacco. "He called me on the phone en route home," DaCosta said. "I could tell by his voice that he was excited, that he thought we were onto something down the road." At that point, McNair was still playing well, and there was no reason to think about drafting a quarterback. By the following fall, with McNair injured, he would retire at season's end, and the team floundering, the situation had become desperate. Looking at the schedule prior to the season, DaCosta saw a unique opportunity on October 27th. Delaware was scheduled to play at Navy at noon, and Clemson was playing at Maryland, 30 miles away in College Park, at 3:30. "It wasn't as if I couldn't drive to Delaware to see Flacco," he said, "but they were playing a Division 1A team in Navy. They might not have been ranked or anything, but it was a step up for Delaware. Plus, I could go watch three quarters in Annapolis, beat the traffic there, and probably get to College Park right around kickoff. I remember Clemson had several players I wanted to see." DaCosta never made it to College Park. He went down onto the field to watch Flacco warm up and liked what he saw from up close. Flacco had size, had huge hands, and threw the ball with an effortless motion. "He had the look," DaCosta said. "The physical attributes were all there, but so was the attitude. Not cocky, but confident." DaCosta went upstairs to eat some pregame pizza and ran into Ron Wolf, the former Packers general manager who had retired to Annapolis. Wolf knew exactly why DaCosta was there. "Looking for your trigger man, Eric?" he asked rhetorically. By halftime, DaCosta was sold, especially after Flacco took his team the length of the field in the final 2 minutes to tie the game at 28-28. "He was like a surgeon during that drive," DaCosta said, his eyes widening and retelling the story more than 10 years later. "Every pass was right there. He knew just what he was doing with the clock. They didn't have any timeouts left, but it didn't matter. He made it look easy." DaCosta ended up leaving before the end of the third quarter, but instead of driving west down Route 50 to the Washington Beltway, he drove north on I-97 back to the Ravens' offices. "I was too excited about Flacco for it to be worth my time to go to College Park," he said. "Even if I had gone, I wouldn't have been focused the way I needed to be. I wanted to go back right then and look at whatever tape we had on Flacco." The Ravens had started the season with a list of four quarterbacks they liked: Matt Ryan of Boston College, Brian Brohm of Louisville, Chad Henne of Michigan, and Flacco. By season's end, the list was down to two: Ryan and Flacco. "We liked Ryan a little bit more than we liked Joe," DaCosta said. "Ryan had played in a big-time program and had been a consistent winner. If we'd had the chance to draft Ryan, we'd have taken him." Flacco had also proven himself a winner during that final season at Delaware. The Blue Hens made the NCAA playoffs and won three games against Delaware State, top-seeded Northern Iowa, and fourth-seeded Southern Illinois to reach the championship game. There, they lost to an Appalachian State team that had started the season by winning at Michigan, a victory so historic it later spawned a book, and ended it by beating Delaware for a third straight national title. The Ravens had finished the season by beating the Pittsburgh Steelers in a meaningless game to finish at 5-11. That turned out to be crucial. Had they lost to the Steelers and finished 4-12, they would have moved up several spots in the draft. Instead, the 4-12 Atlanta Falcons, picking third, drafted Ryan. That was no surprise to the Ravens. They were locked in on picking Flacco if, in fact, Ryan was off the board. DaCosta had little trouble convincing Newsom that Flacco was worth a first-round pick. "I liked what I saw of him, and I had no hesitation taking an FCS 1AA player," Newsom said. Steve McNair had come out of Alcorn State, which was also an FCS school, and had become a star. If you're good enough, you're good enough. In fact, McNair had been the last quarterback from an FCS school taken in the first round when the Houston Oilers had drafted him with the third overall pick in 1995. Newsom wasn't the only one DaCosta had to convince. The Ravens had a new coaching staff. Brian Billick had been fired and replaced by John Harbaugh. Because Harbaugh was tied up hiring a staff and putting together a playbook, he made Cam Cameron the new offensive coordinator and Hugh Jackson, the quarterback's coach, his representatives on the quarterback search. When DaCosta first brought Flacco up to Cameron, he was skeptical. "I wouldn't say he poo-pooed the idea," DaCosta said. "I'd just say he was less than sure." Flacco was invited to the Senior Bowl, which has become a week-long tryout camp for college players. The practices are actually more important than the game because the players, with NFL coaching staffs in charge, are asked to do things that give scouts a chance to judge their skills. Many scouting staffs don't even stay for the game. The Ravens were scheduled to fly out of Mobile, Alabama, site of the game, on Thursday afternoon. On Thursday morning, they went to one last workout and watched all the quarterbacks throw. "The weather was miserable," DaCosta said. "I remember we went upstairs to find cover. You could see, though, that the wind and the rain didn't affect Joe's ball. His passes didn't wobble. They didn't miss their targets. I remember thinking, this guy is an AFC North quarterback," meaning he'd be able to perform in bad weather in Baltimore, Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, and Cleveland in December and January. Next came the combine with all its various tests: height, weight, hand size, arm strength, 40-yard dash, shuttle run. There is also an alleged intelligence test that consists of 50 questions. Some of the smartest quarterbacks ever to play the game haven't done that well on what is called the Wunderlich test, invented by a man named E.F. Wunderlich. It consists of 50 multiple-choice questions that have to be answered in 12 minutes. Only one player, Harvard punter Pat McAnally, ever scored a 50. Ryan Fitzpatrick, who finished in 9 minutes and left one question blank intentionally, scored a 48. 13 of the 21 players who have scored 40 or higher are quarterbacks. For the record, Tom Brady scored a 33 and Flacco scored a 27. Matt Ryan had a 32 at the same combine as Flacco. Disappointing, Flacco said laughing years later. Thought I'd do better. The average score is 20. The Wonderlic can be vastly overrated. The only player to ever score 49 on a Wonderlic was Boston College defensive end Mike Mamula. He so impressed the Philadelphia Eagles scouting staff with his overall performance at the combine that they traded up from the 12th spot to the 7th, giving the Tampa Bay Buccaneers their 12th pick and 2 second-round picks to get Mamula. The Bucs swung another trade and ended up drafting Warren Sapp and Derek Brooks with the picks they got from Philadelphia. Both are in the Hall of Fame. Mamula had a decent 5-year career in Philadelphia, nothing more. The lesson, beware the Wonderlic. Teams have learned that. A.J. Green scored a 10 coming out of Georgia in 2010, was still taken with the 4th overall pick by the Bengals, and is one of the best receivers in the game. After the combine, DaCosta was convinced of two things. Ryan wasn't going to be on the board when the Ravens drafted, and Flacco was their man. He still had to convince the coaches, who would certainly have input with Newsom, before a final decision was made. After the annual combine, high-profile players are often asked to perform for any scouts interested in them in what's called a pro day. Some players skip the combine and hold a pro day instead of the combine. Teams are invited to their college campus on one specific day, and the player performs for all of them at once. Other players, who may not be in quite so much demand, will do individual workouts for teams that request them. The Ravens asked Flacco for an individual workout and scheduled it for the Ides of March. It was cold and rainy, I remember that, DaCosta said. We drove to Newark, Delaware, in 2 cars. Joe Douglas, Joe Hortiz, another scout, and I were in 1 car. Cam and Hugh were in the other. Flacco met the group on an unlined practice field carrying a bag of footballs with 2 of his teammates in tow. Cameron was in charge of the workout. He asked Flacco to make different throws, asked him how he would read certain formations and about how he might handle different protections. What I remember most is that it was sort of like that day in Mobile at the Senior Bowl. Lousy conditions, DaCosta said. Cam kept picking up the pace, barking at Joe. The field we were on wasn't in great shape, and the receivers he was working with weren't guys who were going to play at the next level by any stretch. But he handled everything, never seemed to get rattled, no matter how fast Cam was going. When we were finished, we thanked Joe, and Cam said to me, "I get it now." Assuming we weren't going to get Ryan, we were all in agreement that Joe was the guy we wanted, the guy we really needed to get. That didn't mean DaCosta and Newsom weren't willing to make a couple of moves to strengthen other positions before getting their quarterback. The Ravens were slated to draft 8th, and they certainly wanted to pick Ryan. DaCosta believed, however, that 8 was too high to take Flacco, and that the team should trade back, get other picks to move out of the 8th slot to strengthen their overall draft board. They made a deal with Jacksonville to move all the way down to 26th, picking up 2 later-round picks to let the Jaguars move up. We couldn't take Flacco at 8, DaCosta said. That's just the way the NFL is. People would have laughed at us if we had taken Joe that high, and we were a little sensitive anyway because of what had happened with Bowler. But I knew no one else would take him that high, so I wasn't uncomfortable with moving back. The Ravens got 2 picks, a 3rd and a 4th from the Jaguars, to move back to 26th. DaCosta was comfortable that Flacco would still be there at that spot. But as the first round wore on, Newsom and team owner Steve Bisciotti began to get a little nervous. With Ryan gone, Flacco was the only quarterback they coveted, and they worried someone might make a trade, jump in front of them, and grab him. Finally, with the Houston Texans about to pick, Newsom decided it was time to stop hoping. He traded a 3rd-round pick to the Texans to move up to the 18th spot, and the Ravens grabbed Flacco. There was jubilation in the draft room, except for one problem. Like most NFL teams, the Ravens planned to allow their public relations people, along with the team's video crew, into the room as the pick was being made. DaCosta was supposed to notify Kevin Byrne, the Ravens' vice president of public relations, when the pick was about to be made. But when the trade happened, there was almost no time to give Byrne a heads up, and DaCosta, still thinking the pick was coming at 26, had told Byrne it was okay to take a bathroom break. By the time Byrne returned, the pick had been made. Kevin said, "We have to reenact it," DaCosta remembered laughing. "We had to have the camera crew come into the room first, and then I had to burst into the hallway and scream to Cam, who was down the hall in the coach's room, 'We got our guy!' Then we ran down the hall and hugged. I remember Cam saying to me, 'Let's not ever do that again.'" Regardless of the reenactment, the Ravens had gotten their man. The question now was whether he would become the man. Realistically, they figured it would take a while to find out. They were wrong. 4. Alex Smith and Ryan Fitzpatrick are friends, even though they don't see each other that often. They have played together in the annual celebrity golf tournament at Lake Tahoe, and they often text each other to keep up with families and to offer congratulations or condolences on wins and losses during the course of a football season. As each entered his 14th season in the NFL, their pro careers had followed very different paths. Smith came into the NFL as the number one pick in the entire draft. Fitzpatrick, as he likes to point out, was taken a mere 249 picks later. Fitzpatrick is with his seventh team, Smith his third. Smith has started for most of his career. Fitzpatrick has frequently been the guy who starts because someone else gets hurt or because he has surprised his coaches by outplaying the guy who was supposed to be the starter. But their beginnings were similar. In fact, they might well have been college teammates at Harvard. "I don't think my mother has ever completely forgiven me," Smith likes to say about his college decision. "She wanted me to go to Harvard for the simple reason that it's Harvard." Fitzpatrick did go to Harvard, in part because it's Harvard, but also because he didn't have any scholarship offers from Division I-A schools. Harvard plays one level down in Division I-AA, the same level as Eastern Washington, the other school that showed interest in him. Smith had that one solid Division I-A offer from Utah. He was considered a two-star recruit out of a possible five by College Scouting Services. "If I'd been rated at all, they'd have had to create a half-star category for me," Fitzpatrick often jokes. A two-star prospect is considered a marginal Division I-A prospect. Division I-A is now called the Football Bowl Subdivision by the NCAA, and Division I-AA is called the Football Championship Subdivision because the NCAA doesn't like to imply that any level is superior to another. When Smith arrived at Utah in the summer of 2002, he expected to redshirt as a freshman, which was fine with him. Academically, he was a junior because he had 9 AP credits coming out of high school. That meant his academic workload would be considerably heavier than a typical first-year football player, so not having to worry about playing in games was actually something of a relief. "It wasn't that big a deal," he said, "but not having to worry about playing in games didn't seem like a bad idea." He had been recruited by Ron McBride, who was entering his 13th season at Utah. McBride had turned around a fallen program when he'd taken over in 1990, and Utah had gone to 6 bowl games in his 12 years, including 2001, when it had bounced back from a 4-7 season to go 8-4 with a victory in the Las Vegas Bowl. Smith was slated to sit behind Brett Elliott and Lance Rice, two experienced quarterbacks, and then be given a chance to play the following season. The Utes won their first 2 games, then went into a 6-game nosedive, which meant they wouldn't play postseason and put McBride's job in jeopardy, since it would be the team's second losing season in 3 years. 7 games in, with the team floundering at 2-5, offensive coordinator Craig Versteeg came to see Smith. The coaches had decided to abandon the redshirt for him and play him that week against New Mexico. Smith was more confused than anything else. "It didn't seem to make much sense," he said. "The season was already pretty much lost, and it wasn't as if Brett and Lance had been awful and that playing a freshman was going to suddenly turn things around. I think they were all thinking that if we didn't at least play better, they were going to lose their jobs. So maybe a new voice in the huddle might give the team a boost." He He didn't get to say much, playing briefly in two games and completing 2 of 4 passes, one of the incompletes being an interception returned for a touchdown. He also took a couple of sacks, so his rushing total was 2 rushes for minus 11 yards. It didn't go well, to put it mildly, Smith said. I never really understood why I was in there if they were only going to play me a couple of series. After the 2 cameos, it was back to the bench, his red shirt blown because he had played. If he had been injured, he could have played as many as 3 games and not lost his red shirt. But since his coaches had been holding him out even though he was healthy, his red shirt was gone as soon as he stepped onto the field. I was pretty upset about it at the time, he said. It made no sense to begin with, and even less when they played me for a few minutes and then I never played again. At that point, I certainly wasn't thinking that the NFL draft was going to be a possibility after my 3rd season. McBride was fired at the end of the season. The new coach was 38-year-old Urban Meyer, who had drawn the attention of Utah by going 17-6 in 2 seasons at Bowling Green. Urban's reputation was that he was a little bit crazy, Smith said. He ran this wide-open offense, all shotgun, and he also wanted every single session in the weight room, every single thing you did, to be all out. He was full of intensity, which in the long run worked out very well, but it was a little overwhelming at first. Elliott was still the starting quarterback when the 2003 season began. The Utes beat Utah State in their opener, then lost 28-26 at Texas A&M a week later. Late in that game, Elliott broke his wrist diving for the pylon. Smith took his place, and Utah's version of Wally Pipp, Lou Gehrig, was born. Smith started the last 10 games of that season and all 12 games the next. His first start came in a Thursday night nationally televised game against California, whose quarterback was Aaron Rodgers. Smith completed 18 of 26 passes. Rodgers was 15 of 25, and the Utes won 31-24. The Utes won 5 in a row and climbed to number 23 in the AP poll before losing a 47-35 Donnybrook to New Mexico. Smith was 18 of 32 for 220 yards and 4 touchdowns, but it wasn't enough. Utah then capped its season by beating arch-rival Brigham Young 3-0 in a snowstorm and then pitched another shutout in a 17-0 Liberty Bowl win over Southern Mississippi to finish 10-2, 9-1 with Smith as the starter. Still, the NFL was the furthest thing from his mind when the 2004 season began. In fact, all he was really thinking about was beating Texas A&M, one of the 2 teams Utah had lost to the previous season. The Utes pounded the Aggies 41-21 and went from there to have one of the most dominant seasons in college football history. They were 12-0 and averaged 40 points per game. Their closest game was a 49-35 victory over Air Force. Twice they scored 63 points. Smith completed 67.5% of his passes for almost 3,000 yards out of Meyer's spread offense. By the time the regular season ended with a 52-21 win over BYU, the Utes were ranked 5th and 6th in the 2 national polls, and most important, ranked 6th in the BCS poll. That meant the BCS had to do something it dreaded, extend a bid to one of its 5 bowl games to a school not from one of the Power 6 conferences. At the time, Utah was still part of the Mountain West Conference. In its 7-year history, the BCS had never gone out of the Power 6 to fill its 10 bowl spots. Utah gave it no choice. Of all the things we did that year, I think busting the BCS and forcing them to take us was the one that meant the most to us, Smith said. Our attitude was, whoever we play, we're going to pound them and show them how good a non-power conference school can be. Unfortunately, the BCS chose to send its weakest automatic qualifier, Big East champion Pittsburgh, to the Fiesta Bowl to play Utah. It was most unfortunate for Pitt because Utah did exactly what it came to do, pounding the Panthers 35-7. Smith completed 29 of 37 passes for 328 yards and 4 touchdowns. By then, everyone knew Meyer was leaving to take the job at Florida, and rumors were rife that Smith was going to pass on his senior season. He had finished 4th in the Heisman Trophy voting behind Matt Leinart, Adrian Peterson, and Jason White, 1 spot ahead of his high school teammate Reggie Bush. making them the first players from the same high school team to finish in the top five in the Heisman voting in the same season. Smith's uncle, John L. Smith, had made some informal phone calls to NFL general managers and was being told that his nephew was a likely first-round draft pick. By then, he was 6 feet four, weighed 215 pounds, and had shown both mobility, scoring 10 rushing touchdowns, and arm strength. The only question about taking the step to playing on Sundays was whether he could adapt to a pro-style offense. After the bowl game, Smith decided there was really nothing left to accomplish in college. Meyer was gone, and so was an accomplished senior class. He had asked the NFL's official scouting service to tell him formally where it thought he might be drafted, but the word from his uncle was enough, he thought, to make a decision. In the fourth quarter of the ball game, he could hear the Utah fans chanting, "One more year, one more year." That made the decision harder, but not that much harder. 3 days after the ball game, he made his announcement. He had already graduated the previous spring with a degree in economics and had done some postgraduate work, largely to be eligible to play football. Once he had decided he was headed for the NFL, there was no reason to hang around and not focus on getting ready for all the pre-draft routines players go through: the Senior Bowl, the Combine, a pro day, and private workouts. So he said his goodbyes and loaded up his car for the 10-hour trip back home to San Diego. En route home, his cell phone rang. It was the NFL scouting service with their report on his draft status. They told Smith they believed he'd be drafted at some point during the second round. He kept driving. Aaron Rodgers had also decided to pass on his senior season. Leaving California after a season in which he completed 67.5% of his regular season passes, exactly the same percentage Smith had thrown for in his 12 games at Utah. Rodgers and Smith were considered the two top quarterback names in the draft. Rodgers was, and is, an out-of-the-box type of person. To this day, when he introduces himself on NBC's Sunday Night Football games, the starters introduce themselves rather than the announcers, he will often say, "Aaron Rodgers, Butte Junior College," rather than mentioning Cal, the school where he came to national prominence. "Butte took a chance on me when no one in Division I recruited me," he once said. "Heck, I was only at Cal for 1 year longer than Butte." Rodgers had one offer as a high school senior, to walk on at Illinois. Back then, he was only 5 feet 10 and 170 pounds. A year later, when Cal coach Jeff Tedford came to Butte to look at another player, he was surprised to learn that no one had offered or signed the 6'2", 205-pound quarterback who was throwing rockets. 2 years later, after Rodgers had led Cal to a 10-2 record that included a 23-17 loss to national champion USC, in which Rodgers completed 23 straight passes at one point, there were plenty of scouts who thought Rodgers was likely to be the number one pick in the 2005 draft. The San Francisco 49ers had the first pick. Rodgers had grown up in Chico, about 165 miles north of the Bay Area. He was, for all intents and purposes, a local kid. Chico to nearby Butte, and then south to Berkeley, right across the bay. The 49ers had a new coach that winter, Mike Nolan, the son of Dick Nolan, who had coached the team from 1968 to 1975. He had grown up a football brat, following his father from job to job, much the way a military brat moves when his parent in the military is transferred. Nolan liked the notion that Smith had a more in-the-box personality than Rodgers. Both had strong arms, and both were mobile. Both ran a 4.7 40 at the combine. Not super fast for a quarterback, but plenty fast enough. Smith scored a 40 on the Wonderlic, Rodgers a 35. Given that they are two of football's smartest people, those numbers are more a reflection of the fallacies of the Wonderlic than anything else. By the time the NFL was finished putting the quarterbacks through their paces, it was clear that Smith was not going to be a second-round pick. The only real question was whether the 49ers would take him or take Rodgers. The other was expected to fall until later in the first round, because other teams picking in the first 10 were not necessarily looking for a quarterback. The 49ers were starting from scratch. They had gone 2-14 in 2004, starting the season with Tim Rattay as their quarterback and finishing it with Ken Dorsey playing the position. Coach Dennis Erickson and general manager Terry Donahue were both fired. Nolan was hired to essentially fill both positions, a trend at the time in the NFL. The success of Bill Belichick in New England as dictator of all things encouraged other teams to follow suit. Nolan was a defensive expert. He had been a defensive back in college at Oregon and had spent 1 year of his 23 as a coach on the offensive side of the ball. He had been the defensive coordinator for the Giants, Washington, Jets, and Ravens, the latter for 3 seasons after spending his one and only season on offense coaching wide receivers in 2001. Nolan was very smart and very confident and had lived and breathed football his entire life, which might explain why he laughed it off when Washington's new owner, Dan Snyder, began telling him during the 2000 season what he wanted to see the team's defense doing. He came to me one day and began explaining that he thought our defense was too vanilla, Nolan said several years after escaping Washington. He said he wanted the defense to have more flavor, like Ben and Jerry's ice cream. Nolan decided he knew more about coaching defense than a guy who had made his millions through direct mail advertising. A couple of weeks later, after a loss, he found a pint of multi-flavored ice cream on his desk with a note. "This is what I want from my defense." Nolan responded with a note back to the owner. "Thanks for the ice cream. My kids enjoyed it." Then came a loss at Dallas, the ultimate disaster to Snyder. When the team's charter landed at Dulles Airport, Nolan did what many NFL coaches do on Sunday night. He went straight to the office to begin preparing for the following week. This time, he found an entire crate of ice cream melting on his desk. There was no note. It wasn't needed. A few years later, when Nolan told the story to a reporter, Snyder, through his spokesman, angrily denied that anything along those lines had happened. When Norv Turner, who had been Washington's head coach at the time, confirmed it, Snyder and his spokesman changed their story. They had now decided that it had been general manager Vinny Serrato who had sent the ice cream. By then, Nolan at 45 was a prime candidate to become a head coach. When the 49ers selected him in January 2005, it seemed to make perfect sense. 30 years after his father had last coached in San Francisco, Nolan took over. His first and most important job was to find a quarterback. And so on April 23, 2005, when the NFL draft began at the Jacob Javits Convention Center on the west side of Manhattan, NFL Commissioner Paul Tagliabue stepped to the microphone and announced, "With the first pick in the 2005 NFL draft, the San Francisco 49ers select Alex Smith, quarterback, Utah." Aaron Rodgers would have to wait through 22 more picks before the Packers took him with the 24th pick. Ryan Fitzpatrick would have to wait for 248 picks before being taken by the Rams. The difference was Fitzpatrick wasn't surprised. Rodgers was surprised and a little bit angry. Smith, even though he had heard his name bandied about as possibly being the number one pick, was stunned. "It was a long way from starting my sophomore season as Utah's backup quarterback to being the number one pick in the NFL draft 19 months later," he said. "It was a little bit like, Toto, we aren't in Kansas anymore." He wasn't in Oz either. He was in San Francisco with an entire city, an entire league, monitoring his every step and every misstep. Life in the NFL would be a lot different from life in the Mountain West. 5. Alex Smith was prepared for the media blitz that he knew would come with being the first pick in the NFL draft. Talking to the media has never been a problem for him. This, though, was different. It wasn't just the Bay Area media that wanted to talk to him. It was the national media. After all, he wasn't just the 49ers' first pick. He was the league's first pick. "For the most part, it was fine," he said. "The questions weren't exactly difficult to answer, and in a lot of cases, they were questions I'd been asked multiple times. The hard part was knowing that all eyes were on me all the time. We'd be doing calisthenics in minicamp, and it felt as if all the cameras were on me. There wasn't much downtime or quiet time. Some of it was fun. Heck, I hadn't thrown an interception, and we hadn't lost a game. But from day one, it felt as if I was the face of the franchise. That's a little bit tough when you haven't played a down yet." The quantum change in Smith's life hit him in the face one afternoon when he went to the bank. He had opened an account locally and at the end of the team's second rookie minicamp found 2 checks in his locker. NFL players receive about 95% of their salary during the 17 weeks of the regular season. During the off-season, they received small checks for mini-camps, now officially known as off-season team activities, OTAs, and for exhibition games. Soon after he signed his contract in July, Smith noticed two checks in his locker. One was for $1,000 and the other was for $700. He went to the bank, filled out a deposit slip, and waited his turn in line. As he was waiting, he glanced at the checks. That was when he noticed that the $1,000 check wasn't for $1,000. It was for $1 million, Smith said with a sheepish grin. I had misread the zeros. In my defense, I'd never seen a check even close to that big. It turned out it was part of my signing bonus. Smith quickly stepped out of line and rewrote the deposit slip. I also set up direct deposit that day, he said. I didn't really want to get that look from the teller again. That was the day it really hit me that my life had undergone a radical change. It's not as if I grew up poor, but I was one of five kids and my dad was a high school principal. I know he never found himself holding a $1 million check. It wasn't a bad thing, but it was certainly eye-opening. So was his rookie season. Even though Smith was the most watched player on the 49ers preseason roster, Mike Nolan and offensive coordinator Mike McCarthy had no intention of rushing him. Nolan had seen what playing from week one had done to Kyle Bowler in Baltimore in 2003. Even though the Ravens had made the playoffs with a 10-6 record, most people, correctly, credited the defense for that success. Bowler was doubted from day one and never completely recovered from the microscope he was put under. Nolan didn't want that to happen to Smith, even though it was inevitable, whether he delayed it or not. Tim Rattay was again the starter when the 49ers opened the season with a win against the St. Louis Rams. A week later, during a 42-3 blowout loss to the Eagles, Smith made his debut, coming in to throw one incomplete pass during the 49ers' final possession of the game. Then it was back to the bench until week four, when he again came in to mop up during a 31-14 loss to the Cardinals. This time, though, Smith completed six passes in his relief appearance. Nolan decided it was time for the future of the franchise to become the present. It wasn't an easy situation to step into for anyone. The 49ers had a porous offensive line, and even though Smith was elusive, he was sacked five times by the Colts in his starting debut. He also threw four interceptions and Indianapolis cruised to a 28-3 victory. The next week wasn't much better. Smith was again sacked five times. He threw just one interception, but also lost a fumble. And Washington embarrassed San Francisco 52-17. Smith was in and out of the lineup the rest of the season, ultimately playing in nine games on a team that finished 4-12. He threw one touchdown pass and 11 interceptions, hardly what he or the 49ers had been hoping for when he was drafted. It was, to say the least, a tough year, he said, looking back. Everything I did, good or bad, mostly bad, was dissected. We just weren't very good, and I never felt as if I was the guy the way I wanted to be the guy. But I guess it's fair to say I wasn't the first quarterback to struggle breaking in with a bad team my rookie year. That's certainly true. Troy Aikman had gone 1-15 as a rookie in Dallas. Peyton Manning was 3-13 in his first season in Indianapolis. The Rams were 4-12 in Jared Goff's first season in 2016. Carson Wentz, drafted behind Goff at number two that spring, was 7-9 as the Eagles starter. More often than not, when a quarterback is drafted number one, it is to join a bad team. Andrew Luck was drafted by a Colts team that had just gone 2-14 in 2011, but a lot of the reason for the Colts' failures that season was the loss of their star quarterback, Peyton Manning. The Colts went 11-5 in Luck's rookie season and made the playoffs, but they were the exception, not the rule. Mike McCarthy left the 49ers following the 2005 season to become the Packers' head coach. There, he would eventually make the switch from Brett Favre to Aaron Rodgers at quarterback after Rodgers spent most of three seasons observing from the sidelines. Smith's new offensive coordinator was Norv Turner, who had been fired at the end of 2005 as the head coach in Oakland. Nolan had worked for him in Washington and quickly snapped him up. Smith loved working with Turner, who liked to throw the ball downfield more often than McCarthy had in the West Coast offense, which is built around shorter, more high-percentage passes. He was now the team's unquestioned starter. In fact, he took every snap during the 2006 season, and the 49ers improved to 7-9. Smith's highlight and the team's highlight may have come during a Thursday night football national telecast against the Seattle Seahawks. Chris Collinsworth, doing the color on NBC, commented early in the game that given a choice, he would have taken Denver rookie QB Jay Cutler over Smith if the two had been in the same draft. He added that he also thought two other 2006 rookies, Matt Leinart and Vince Young, were clearly superior to Smith. But after Smith's